Right, good evening, all. My name's Tony Travers from LSE London, and I'd like to welcome you to this, the first in our annual series of Lenten seminars, which previously have taken place, some matter less being incredibly inside, but under the banner of the Economics Department, that are now happily ensconced within the Geography Department, under the banner of Urban and Regional Economics, which has been created. Anyway, welcome all from inside and outside the school. We've got a series of seminars running right the way through the term on a number of aspects of London and some of it's about the economics of London, some of it slightly less so, other aspects of the city. And to start us off this afternoon, we have Philip Clifford. Philip is from the strategic policy team at London Councils. I think it's fair to say that London Councils have done a great deal of work on the impact or the potential impact of what is to be a radical reform of the benefits system. I'll say a little more other than say that the government's clearly decided that many aspects of the social welfare and benefits system need to be reformed, and almost inevitably, because of the high costs of housing benefit and other social security costs, or the need to pay people more in London because the cost of living in London are often higher, the potential impact of a cap on the total amount a household can receive is clearly likely to be greatest in London, that perhaps particularly in inner London. Anyway, we'll hear more about that now, about how many households are likely to be affected, what the impact on those households is likely to be, and perhaps then we can discuss more widely about what the impact might be on London more generally. Philip.
Okay. All right. Thank you. As you said, I'm Philip Clifford, and I'm from London Councils, and I'd just like to say thank you for inviting me here today to talk about a piece of research we commissioned last year that looked at the impact of the changes for the cap, total benefit cap under universal credit on households in London. Before I get into that though too deeply, I should probably quickly say a couple of words about the welfare system in this country as far as I can describe. I'm not an expert on it, but just a bit of background, just a bit of context. So I think it's reasonably fair to say that the current welfare system in this country is exceptionally complex and exceptionally difficult to easily describe in a kind of short paragraph. A lot of the people who work in it and who know a lot about it are almost akin to a monastic order in the sense that it's a lot of different interacting systems that basically break down into two components of benefit entitlement. So basically your cost of living entitlement, which is income support, job seekers allowance, that kind of thing, and then a housing benefit component that sits separately with that. And I know, and if you know more about it, you might think that's a little bit of a crude way of describing it. But I think that provides a useful departure, a useful starting point for working through the rest of this project. And basically, focusing on the housing benefit element of that for a second, if you live in social housing, then your benefit is, the benefit system pays your entire social rent. So if you live in, for example, a local authority property or a registered social landlord, then that rent is covered by the benefits. If you live in private rented accommodation, and it's worth bearing in mind that there's currently haven't really built that many social homes in this country since, I don't know, for at least the last 10, 15 years. It's been a long-term decline in the availability of social homes. So increasingly, the amount of affordable homes, affordable housing, is in the private sector. So in terms of your rent in the private sector, what the government has devised, or what the Department of Work and Pension has devised, is a thing called broad rental market areas. Now, very simply, these are areas which, geographic areas, which basically take a sample of rents within that area. So London, for example, is divided into 14 different broad rental market areas. And that provides a proxy for the level of market rent in that area. Now, I'll get to the changes in a minute, but I think that's worth bearing in mind. So right at the outset, the housing benefit component that pays your private sector rent doesn't cover all the rents, but it covers a percentage of the rents of a geographically defined market area. Okay, so, and for the purposes of this, seminar and indeed the research, the benefit cap I'm referring to is a total cap in as far as it applies to housing benefit costs. And I'll step through what that means as we go through the presentation. Okay, so I'd just like to begin with a bit of background about who are London councils, what are the key welfare reform changes we're talking about, and a bit of context around the welfare reform debate. I won't spend too long on it, but I think it's worth, again, having that in your head before we move on to the actual commissioning of the research and the findings of the research. Okay, so this is a map of London. London Councils is a cross-party policy development and lobbying organisation that represents London's 33 councils. The colours correspond to the political parties, so blue is Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, kind of gold, and Labour is red. And you should be able to deduce from this that the majority of boroughs in London are red, so 17 London boroughs. And because we're cross-party, although we have a Labour-led leadership, political leadership, we generally try to work on a cross-party consensus pan-London kind of basis. It's probably worth saying, again at the outset, that on something as tricky and as controversial as welfare reform, it can be very difficult to get a line that all parties can agree to on that we can go out as a line from London councils. So individual boroughs might have their own particular views about it. For example, the views of Westminster might be very different from the views of Lambeth. But as a cross-party organisation, the view that we come to has to sit well with each of the leaders from those boroughs. We are based in London Bridge in a reconditioned asbestos factory that's now mercifully free of asbestos. So, and we basically work in different policy areas, different teams. So there'll be a housing team, a transport and environment team, and I work in the strategic policy team. And my involvement is basically that I was responsible for commissioning this piece of work and trying to tie in all the other teams within the organisation so we can get a kind of feel and buy-in from across the team. Okay, so these are the key changes, I think, that the research really addresses. So the local housing allowance is the part, if you think back when I mentioned the broad rental market areas and the housing benefit component for people in private sector, well, that's called the local housing allowance. There are changes to that that have already come into effect in a move to limit the amount of housing benefit paid to people in the private rented sector. The universal credit is a all-encompassing, radical reform of the welfare system that's due to come into effect in 2013. Now, there's a lot of conversation and a lot of hard work going into trying to make that happen because it is really quite fundamental. It's really quite a massive change. And to put it briefly, what the universal credit is basically going to do is transform that very complicated, very tangled mess of different benefit entitlements into one single credit. So rather than having your income support component or your housing benefit component, there will be a single payment that you receive from the government, and that will be your total entitlement. Now, there are some, I think it's widely accepted, there's some very good reasons for doing this. One, the current system is very complicated and expensive to administer. So the idea of the universal credit will allow a great deal of greater simplicity, and also it's going to be used to reduce fraud and at the same time involve some transfer to a kind of digital economy. So rather than going down to your housing benefit office, you'll be able to do this online. And that creates some of its own operational issues, but it's really, I think it's worth, and I mentioned this just to kind of really underline the fact that the universal credit is going to be transformative. And generally, people don't have an argument with that. The specific component of the universal credit, however, that the research focuses on, is that as well as bringing all the different benefit streams into one, the government has said that there will be a cap on the total amount of benefit that each person receives. So if you're a single person household, that cap will be £350, and if you're a couple, then that's £500. Now, there are two bits of this. One, under the current benefit system, you can receive more than that in benefit. I think that's the fundamental thing to find out, particularly in London where rents can be anything up to £1,000 a week. The amount of benefit that the household in London will receive, or the large household in London receives, could be much higher than that. That's worth flagging up. The second bit is how the government has arrived at this cap. And this really kind of I'll explore in more detail in a couple of more slides. But these numbers haven't been built up. These numbers haven't been built up out of an estimate of people's ability to pay or people's demands on their wages or anything. It's been pitched because £500 per week is basically approximate to the average median wage of working household in Britain. So the government has kind of argued for these caps on the basis that these need to be fair. People on benefits should not receive more in benefit than the average working household. And that's really the kind of jumping up point. So in the background, of course, and partly, you know, and this is probably not going to surprise, partly why the concept of a cap really has kind of broad political support is the cost of housing benefit, or the amount of money that's spent on housing benefit. And this is a graph that goes from 1997 to 2011, and this looks at total housing benefit expenditure in London and England. And you can see that for England, the housing benefit bill has risen from about 9.6 billion to 18.8 billion, and in London it's risen from about 2.6 to 5.5. Now, it's increased quite a lot over this intervening period. There are a lot of factors in that, and there are a lot of complications that I won't get into at the moment, but suffice to say, it's increasing. And I don't know and as the economy continues to downturn or go through a period of contraction, the risk is, therefore, that people you'll get a kind of what they call the scissors of doom. So tax take will decrease, and reliance on social security will increase. So this could potentially keep going up. So there is an economic case in the background about getting a handle on the total benefit expenditure, which partly supports the argument around the cap. There's also, as I kind of alluded to, a political context. This is a word or a word cloud taken from a popular British newspaper based on the last 10 stories around the benefit cap. And you can see what jumps out, really: families, weak, rent, London, about perceived infairness or unfairness within the kind of housing benefit system. And it's particularly targeted, this kind of sense of injustice, around a very limited number of families. Very limited number of families with, say, 10, 12 children living in very expensive parts of the country. And they are a tiny fraction of the overall percentage of household benefit claimants. But they make a lot of noise. And particularly within the economic context that we're in, there's been a lot of concern and a lot of argument about what should be seen to be done. It goes back to what I said about the government's basis, the government's argument for this, being kind of rooted in fairness. So that's the kind of political and economic context for this. I'd just like to kind of close the kind of introduction bit with a quick talk about a mention of London. And if it's not yet obvious to you, then hopefully this graph will help, that the universal credit cap, the £350 for an individual, £500 per week for a household, is a national cap. So it's been the context of a rising benefit bill, and it's been the context of this debate around fairness, but it is a national cap. Now, this graph shows London median wages and the England average median wages, and over from the period of 2002 to 2011. And you can see that London wages are about 25% higher than the rest of the country. So that immediately kind of jumps out as something as, hang on a minute, if you're going to have a national cap, then London is likely to be hit a little harder than the rest of the country. I haven't put it up here because the data is a little difficult to kind of line up, but I managed to track down from the Survey of English Housing the difference between rents in London and the rest of the country, and on the basis of that, it looks about 50 to 60% more expensive to rent in the private rented sector than the rest of the country, and that's basically sustained over the last 10 years since the data has been around. So that should tell you that London has much higher housing costs, and Tony said this in the beginning, and generally higher wages. So if you're going to have a national cap, that immediately sets alarm bells ringing. London Council's, in thinking this through, thought about, hang on a minute, we have a vague idea that this could be potentially difficult for households in London and potentially for local authorities in delivering services for them. So what we did summer last year is we commissioned Navigant Consulting to carry out a piece of research called Does the Cap Fit? And this is the kind of main, I guess the findings of this is the kind of main body of the presentation, and which really looked at what would be the impact of a total benefit cap on London and how that would play out with both the impact on individual households and also potentially on local authority services. Okay, so as I said, the kind of aim was to determine the impact of the local housing allowance and the total benefit cap on housing affordability in London. The local housing allowance is interesting, not only in and of itself, but also because we think it provides or would provide a useful proxy for how, since the local housing allowance does take some account of household size and geographic variation in rent prices, how that would contrast with the universal credit benefit cap, which doesn't take anything at all. Implicit, also within our brief, was a desire to move the debate around welfare reform and the debate around the universal credit out of, for want of a better phrase, the housing box. So up until that point, fairly or unfairly, I think probably unfairly, changes to welfare reform, changes to housing benefit had primarily been seen with a kind of housing hat on, from a housing perspective, what it was going to do with allocations policies, what it was going to do potentially to impact on new supply, those kind of things. Now, there was a desire to move that and to try and get a better handle on what the potential implications of universal credit total benefit cap would be on the wider picture. What Navigant went today, when Navigant went away and did, was they basically crunched 480,000 housing benefit records taken from 24 London boroughs, about 70% of the total benefit caseload in London. And they ran it through a calculation that basically, using the kind of current methodology around, go back to the, what I said about the division between money for cost of living expenses and money for housing expenses, they took the assumptions, because as I said, there isn't a lot of detail about how the universal credit will be calculated. They took assumptions around people's living costs, benefits, and like the job seekers allowance, council tax credit, child benefit, and then worked out, based on how much rent they were currently paying, how much they would have left over. And just a kind of methodological point, although the cap is mooted to be at £500 a week, they worked back and looked at what the cap would have been in summer last year, i.e. £467, just so it was fair. And that really formed the main kind of quantitative piece of research. As a kind of follow-up, we also ran four task and finish groups with experts from each of the four policy areas up on the screen, just to get a feel for some of the qualitative impacts coming up. And I think it's fair to say that for many of those people, it was as much of a wake-up call as getting evidence from them. But we'll have a look at the main kind of quantitative findings now. Okay, so this is a map that shows you. Before I tell you what it shows you, I think it's probably important to flag up that our initial assumptions about what the research would show was that inner London would be completely unaffordable, and there would be a halo of affordability round out of London. It was very much, as well as being seen as a housing problem, it was very much seen as an inner outer London tension. And for our members and also for us, this was a particular issue about what we could say and what we could do about the benefit cap. Now, I don't know how easy it is to see, but dark is bad. So if you can deduce from where you're sitting that we don't really have an inner outer London problem. We have patches of problem that extend right out to the inner reaches, outer reaches. So we've got Redbridge with 30% of people hit, and Croydon again with 31% of people hit. And when I say hit, I mean hit by either the local housing allowance or the universal credit cap in an absolute sense. So what this graph does is tell the percentage of households whose rent is unaffordable, either on the local housing allowance or the universal credit cap, and how that and but it doesn't tell you how much they're affected. But you can see that the idea that it's purely an inner London problem or purely not an out London problem isn't necessarily borne out by the findings of the research.
Sorry, can you define unaffordable?
So, all right, by unaffordable, if we go back to the calculation that where they looked at your kind of current entitlement on income, around your income benefits, and they worked out how much rent you're currently paying, then if you were over by, it doesn't take a view about how unaffordable it is or the degree of unaffordability, so if you're short by a penny, then you'll be picked up as unaffordable on this. If you're the same way as if you're short by £1,000. It just looks at it's a simple calculation as to how much you're getting in income support benefit, or projects that you will, and deducts that your rent from the total universal credit cap, if that makes sense.
So it's basically saying But these proportions are people who these proportions are people who get less assistance than the basic laws would provide.
Yeah, it's basically saying that if the universal credit cap or the total housing allowance cap came in tomorrow, then in Havering, 20% of people would find their rent unaffordable to some degree.
Unaffordable by the government standards of what they provide.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Is that 20% of people on benefits or 20% of the population?
Oh, sorry, people in receipt of either the local housing allowance, which is both applicable to workless and working households, and the universal credit cap, which is only applicable to workless households. Okay. So what this second graph seeks to show you is that the number of people hit by the local housing allowance and the universal credit total benefit cap is broadly the same. Broadly, 10% of the headline figure of 130,000 households are hit by either one of them. And that's worth bearing in mind because when you look at this next graph, what it shows you is that, what it hopes to show you is that the universal credit hits a lot harder than the local housing allowance. So both the universal credit total benefit cap and the local housing allowance hit the similar number of apportioned households. But the universal credit hits hard, and you can see this if you look at the kind of orange line, which is the local housing allowance line. You can see that the majority of cases in the case study sample are hit to the degree of 0 to £10. So when we talk about the extent to which they'll be short their rent, the majority of them are in the 0 to £10. Not so many, if you look at the kind of fainter beige line, well, not so many are hit by the 0 to £10, but if you move further down to, say, 101 to £125, you can see a lot more people are hit by the universal credit to the tune of 101, £125 than there are by the local housing allowance. So when the universal credit hits, it hits a lot harder. And that's something which, we'll have a look at why that might be and who that might affect. So this graph, I realise, is a bit complicated, but it's necessarily complicated. Across the bottom, and you'll probably see this more closely on the actual slide itself, but across the bottom we have basically family typologies, and they go from the blue on the left-hand side is basically a single-parent household with no children. And at the far end, we've got 4B, 4C, that's two adults and four plus children. So basically it's a sliding scale of household size. And what this hopefully shows you is if at the far end, if you see this yellow block here, well, the percentage of people, and that refers to the family size on the bottom, the percentage of people hit by these larger numbers, so £150 to £200, £300, £500, the increasing amount of them are larger families. So if you think back to the previous slide, where it kind of showed the number of people hit and hit hard by the universal credit cap, this gives you a flavour of who those people are. Well, they're likely to be larger families, which kind of stands to reason, because they'll live in larger houses which have higher rents, and they'll have more outgoings, simply on the basis of the fact that they're a larger family. So our kind of initial kind of take-home message was that not only does the universal credit harder, it hits families harder, and there isn't necessarily it's not necessarily an inner outer London problem, which is quite interesting. Before I get on to kind of summarising, I think it was worth mentioning we also got Navigant to look at, as we phrased it, commonly discussed mitigations. And go back to what I was saying about the delicacy and the difficulty of London councils agreeing a cross-party line. So at the time, it was still in discussion as to what our line would be on what we would do or lobby for on the cap. So we asked Navigant to look at two different things that were in kind of play at the time. One on exempting child benefit from the universal credit calculation, and another bit of sensitivity analysis around using the London median wage rather than the national average wage. And just in case not clear, the orange line at the top is the base case, and this again uses the same case study boroughs. And you can see the beige line is the London weighted cap, and the beige line is the child benefit cap, and the darker line is the London weighted cap. And you can see, I suppose it would stand to reason, that the number of households hit drops as you exempt child benefit, and also as you exempt the as you move to the London weighted cap. I.e., if you use a London weighted cap to determine the total benefit cap in London, less people find their rents unaffordable, which I guess kind of stands to reason. And if you're a bit more kind of technical about it, you can see that the child benefit element kind of tapers up, kind of really comes into its own as the loss gets bigger, i.e. households get bigger. So you can see that this lines up with the previous understanding that the majority of people who suffer likely to suffer larger losses are likely to be larger houses, larger households. Now, it's probably a bit difficult to tell from that graph, but if you scale it all up and apply it at a London regional level, we estimated that the London median wage, if you use the London median wage to calculate the cap in London, then it drops the number of households affected by the universal credit total benefit cap from about 74,000 to about 35,000, so it's about 50%. If you exempt child benefit, then it has an impact, but it doesn't have as much of an impact. It drops the total households affected from 74,000 to about 55,000. So it does have an effect, but again, not quite as much of an effect as the London median wage. Okay, so I think I've kind of largely covered this, apart from the total number of people affected, which was 130,000. And I could say a little more about how the extent of people are affected. But I think these were the main findings of our report. These are the main findings of our research. And again, as I said, the most surprising thing was geographic variation, that it wasn't simply an inner outer London problem, but also the extent to which the universal credit hit households as opposed to the local housing allowance. So having got this evidence base of what we thought would actually, or the potential impact of the universal credit cap in London, we then set about thinking about what the potential implications for people, for local authority services, and also for local authority budgets. So we start with people. I think it's fair to say that the $64,000 question that was in the back of our minds when we first commissioned this research was there some way of predicting what people would do in response to these changes? I think we were a little ahead of ourselves in the fact that at one stage we thought it would be possible to look at the impact of a household and then have some rough calculation. For example, if a house loses £5, well, they might make that loss up themselves. If a house loses 50 or £500, well, crikey, they're not going to be able to stay in the house. They'll have to move or they'll have to do something else. With hindsight's a wonderful thing, as the research went on, it became methodologically unsound to pursue that as an avenue investigation. And we ended up with a situation where we had a range of people who would likely to move from 5,000 to 20,000. You just can't make reasoned arguments on that basis. Having said that, and having explained it at length as to why we are unable to do that calculation, it is still the question that comes back both internally and people externally: what are people actually going to do? And the short answer is, it's a bit like time travel. The quickest way to find out is to monitor and actually see what people do, rather than try and predict. So, in thinking about the kind of things that people might do, there are a number of scenarios. Do they choose to overcrowd by living in a substandard accommodation? Do they simply move home? Do they split? Simon Hughes was making a point over the weekend about the possible implications of a household splitting. And the reason why that works is because under the cap, if you were a household and you get £500 regardless of your family size, well, if you split into two, then that's two times 500, so the argument goes, and then you'd be entitled to £1,000. How likely that is, and whether it's simply a kind of exercise, a kind of rational exercise, intellectual exercise, we're not sure. But that again is something that appears to come back to us when we think about what people might or might not do. People might also enter the labour market, which I think is part of the rationale for capping it. But they also might absorb the shortfall. It's difficult to be able to predict what people are actually going to do, and we wouldn't want to be weren't in a position to really make kind of sound judgments about what we thought people might do. However, we are in the process at the moment starting to get up a a view of way, a way of tracking or monitoring people's movements around London, simply from a kind of demand side analysis for each of the boroughs, just to kind of get a view on where it's possible, how people are moving, where people are moving to within London. It's not entirely, you know, rigorously set up. It does, and it probably wouldn't tell us all about people who are choosing to overcrowd or people who are hidden overcrowding. But it would allow us to get a handle on where we think people are actually moving around London. It's worth saying, actually, at this point, giving a quick mention of some other research we did into the effectiveness of the universal credit. So this piece of research looked primarily at the impact of the total benefit cap on London households. We also commissioned some other research that looked at the ability of the universal credit to incentivize people back into work. Because one of the concerns about the current system is that as people move into work, they face a benefit withdrawal rate that basically discourages them from work. So if they're moving off benefits into a job, they can face a marginal taxation rate of about 70%. And the universal credit, is by simplifying things and by tackling that directly, is supposed to address that kind of attrition rate of encouraging people back to work. Unfortunately, in some cases, particularly in for lone parents and for second earners, the second bit of research by Sessi, which is also available on our website, but suggests that the universal credit still won't solve that problem. So it still won't, in some cases, won't make sense. Work won't pay for people to move into employment off benefits. So there are, so entering the labour market isn't quite as simple as a suggestion it might be. Okay, so the impact potentially on borough services, by London boroughs, from people moving and also from people's change in circumstances suffering from alcohol are pretty, well, they're pretty wide ranging. If I deal with the kind of housing ones first, we're already seeing, it's already being reported that we're seeing increased use in temporary accommodation through some quirk in the kind of current regime where there's more grant available, more cash available for people living in temporary accommodation than there is from them living in the private rented sector. So there's been increased use of temporary accommodation. Other changes to government housing policy in terms of new affordable housing supply basically put a greater weight on the rental income of affordable housing providers. So there are potential implications there of moving to a revenue-led supply model in terms of rent arrears, in terms of stability, in terms of deliverability, that are also difficulty from the universal credit. Simply because if you're looking at people who are currently in affordable rented property, social housing, they move over to universal credit, they suddenly potentially suffer a loss in their benefit entitlement, they won't be able to pay their rents. If you're relying on those rents to pay the debt you've taken out to build more homes, that makes the model more difficult to run. And also, as I said earlier, if people overcrowd, well, overcrowding is linked to a whole range of negative externalities, from tuberculosis to poor educational attainment to child protection, you name it. So the problems facing housing are pretty well known, but they're also pretty substantial. On the children and young people side, I think it's worth saying, kind of as an adjunct to the overcrowding, that an absolute loss in household income is likely to lead to increase in child poverty, but perhaps more, which is, I guess, should be kind of relatively clear. But also, what came back from our experts groups was a concern around safeguarding. And there are kind of two bits to that. One is that some children are currently not at risk, but might be at risk if the household suffers a loss of income. But secondly, if a child is forced to move from one borough, which might necessarily be on the at-risk register at the moment, move to another borough where they're below the radar, then something might happen and the services won't be able there to pick it up. Also, London is currently short by about 70,000 school places, so the potential demographic movement or potential movement of people around London, it sets up a dynamic where people tend to move pretty quickly, it takes ages to build a planned school, there isn't the cash available, you end up with potentially children travelling around London, there are child protection issues that come out of that as well. And I just quickly mentioned the adult social care communication. Adult social care, it's quite an interesting one in that a lot of people currently delivering adult social care are pretty, pretty poorly, but they're at the kind of lower end of the wage scale. And there's a chance that if they're not able to afford their rent in London or not able to work in London, then they'll have to travel in, which makes the labour supply for those services delivered by local authorities, and also potentially for the NHS, because there's a kind of crossover for like the healthcare auxiliaries. It also potentially impacts on people's mental health, and strange enough, on service demand, because some of the changes that I haven't mentioned potentially will see people who are currently stay-at-home carers, they'll no longer be able to stay at home and look after an elderly relative because of the changes to more fundamental changes to the healthcare system. So that sets up a service demand, which potentially increases the financial demand on local authorities. So, which was kind of the quantitative stuff. Now this map kind of looks like a little bit of an explosion, but if I try to explain, it'll become make more sense. So each of these stars is a household. It's a household that we have postcode data for that was collected in that borough trawl of housing benefit records. So each star is a household that was picked up. Now, not all of the boroughs that we picked up we had postcode information for, but for 16 of them, we did. So each of those households, each of those docs is basically a household. Now, what our finance team back at London Councils has developed or was working on was this idea of a revenue spend proxy. In very simple terms, that tries to work out the amount of cash a local authority has on a individual, on a per capita basis. It's a combination of council tax, formula grant, and then it's a social care grant. So it attempts to come up with a number for each local authority in London, how much cash is attached to each individual. And what they noticed in having come up with this calculation is that there was a pretty strong correlation between deprivation and the amount of cash awarded to each authority. So from this, and the kind of shading on this map, hopefully will be recognisable to you, is the index of multiple deprivation in London. So what we're currently working through is it's our kind of supposition that the households likely to move around London are likely to have a higher amount of cash, a higher amount of public service expenditure attached to them than your average household. Simply if you're, and I think we kind of take that as a, on the basis that if you're workless, you've got a lot of children living in a deprived area, there's likely to be more money spent on you by your local authority than I don't know, someone who isn't workless and someone who isn't in a deprived area. So what we're trying to get a feel for is if people move around London, or if people move from one borough to the next, then we're not talking about there'll be a change in demand on the local borough services. So if you're currently living in Waltham Forest, I don't know, you might be notionally there might be £1,500 marked against you. If you move to Bromley, then that £1,500 no longer comes out of Waltham Forest borough budget, but now comes out of Bromley's budget because you're moving and you have a drain on services. So what we're trying to get our heads around is if we get back from our kind of monitoring of household movement, if it turns out that a lot of people are moving around London and that isn't picked up by the current financing mechanism that government uses to award money to local authorities, then you could potentially be looking at a situation where a lot of people with a lot of needs move around London in a relatively short space of time, and they move from a place where they're currently funded and currently matched to places where there is no service provision for them. And that, you're not just looking at changes in service standard or service delivery, or even discontinuity of provision in the sense that if you're a vulnerable child, then you know your team, the team knows you. Well, you might move to a place where there isn't a vulnerable child's team to look after you in the same way, or there simply isn't the cash, or a shortage of places, a shortage of staff to look after you. So again, it's not fully worked out, and it was originally predicated on the idea, if they go back, that there will be a movement from inner London to outer London, where the funding formulas are a little more stark. But it is just to flag up that we are trying to think about, if people move, well, not only will there be these kind of, quantitative elements of impact on service, but there are also potentially financial impacts as well as people get displaced around London, or indeed out of London. Okay. I just thought I'd like to bring it to a kind of close with a couple of thoughts about what's happening at the moment and how this piece of research and how our work on this has played into our own lobbying and the kind of debates around. And just to kind of, I guess, tie up with the beginning section and just kind of hopefully give you a better feel for what we do and how what we've done on this fits with our kind of political and policy objectives. Okay, so for those of you not in the know, this guy is called Migraine Boy, and he was invented in 1992 by a guy called Greg Thiering. And I don't think he never really achieved anything other than cult popularity. But when I think about the decisions for households, and when I think about the decisions facing local authorities, having spoken to them, Migraine Boy's permanent headache comes to mind. So, because it is going to be a headache, not only in the context of what do households do, how do households respond to it, but also how do local authorities respond to changes, potentially rapid changes in service demand, in a way that how do they kind of align themselves to address these changes and also keep track of what everyone else is up to. As you might know, but not know, the Welfare Reform Bill is currently in the Lords at the moment, and the particular clause 94, is due to be discussed, I think, next Tuesday. So we are in the process of considering tabling amendment to look at this, and I don't know if people have picked up, there seems to be some potential for some movement. I mean, there's nothing concrete, but there's a lot of scuttlebutt, a lot of chatter about what might or might not happen, particularly given the recent defeats of the government by the Lords. That's probably, again, worth saying that the government can reverse the changes made by the Lords when it goes back to the Commons. But what I think we're seeing, and I say this tentatively, is that the debates around the cap have kind of moved to a place where people are more kind of willing to accept the cap, but within the context of the fact that there are likely to be different cost pressures facing people as in different parts of the country. So we will be waiting and seeing what happens next Tuesday. But I think what we'd like to see isn't necessarily a reversal of the cap. I think the cap probably will stay, but potentially some movement around it. Now, that doesn't provide Nurofen. That's not going to solve the headache in London or households, because go right back to the opening slides. One, we've got the kind of political argument about what is fair, what isn't fair. That is not going to go away anywhere soon, particularly given the financial and fiscal period we're in at the moment. So that isn't going to go anywhere. And also, if you also think back to the first graph around the costs of housing benefit, that graph that kind of went up like that, well, whatever government is in power, there is going to be a desire to be seen to be prudent and seem to get a handle on the benefit costs. So I don't think that the cap is necessarily going to disappear. I don't think that local authorities will get a big truckload of money to help them change their services. But potentially there might be some movement around it, which potentially might make the process easier or help put in some kind of transitional arrangement, so that it isn't quite as stark and households have a chance to adjust and local authorities have a chance to reconfigure their services. So we're kind of cautiously optimistic on that one. And I'd just like to end, I guess, with a slide about what I think are the lessons from having worked on this, and also having kind of seen the way the debate goes. And I guess the one thing that kind of jumps out at me is that the welfare reform process, the universal credit total benefit cap, is really an excellent lesson in the tensions between a national number, a national kind of limit, and the geographic variation in wages and costs and benefits around the country. So it was always going to be difficult to have a national cap and London subject to the same cap as Lancashire, for example, just simply because of the way that's made up. But it really does offer a kind of textbook illustration of, hang on a minute, here's a national policy, and there are going to be implications in different parts of the country. I also think it offers a reasonable insight into the kind of unfolding process, the dialogue between both local authorities and the DWP, and between the opposition and the coalition government around well, around the kind of politics of fairness and how that plays out, and how that how a very kind of very robust line and a very kind of firm ambition of the government hasn't changed, but I think it's shifting potentially, and how not only the work that we've commissioned but other people have played into this debate, how the debate has really unfolded, and how we've seen a kind of very ambitious government move very quickly on some very complicated issues. And I think there's an interesting dynamic there between the kind of initial impetus and how the detail on something like this is developed and refined or modified. And finally, I think, go back to our $64,000 question, and again, what my bosses at London Councils and elsewhere tended to ask me, what's going to happen, where are these people going to go? Well, it's just too early to say. And I think that we can suspect and we can, you know, theorise, and we can say, well, you know, crikey, if you're suffering a £500 a week loss or whatever, then you're going to move out, surely. Well, we can say that, and we could assert that, but we couldn't base policy reasonably on that. But so what it teaches us is that what kind of instructs us is that we're going to have to keep an eye on this, and I, you know, both London Councils and other organisations, and probably indeed the government, a long term view on what the implications is, because it's going to take a while to play out. Because one of the things I should have mentioned at the beginning, which just reminded me, is that the universal credit comes in 2013, but it's going to be rolled out over a 4 or 5 year period. So how this will all play out, how this will actually impact on people, and what the long term implications are, they're going to take time, and they're going to need a lot of thought and a lot of careful monitoring about that. And I think that's me. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Right, please make yourself comfortable. Now, thank you for an excellent exposition, which I know is an extremely complex area. I just about understood most of it, I think. But would anybody like to ask a question or add a thought about their imagined expected impact? Okay, these are the rules. Let's say who you are, or roughly anyway, if you'll take one, two.
Alan Evans, University of Reading. Going back to your first map, which showed that it wasn't actually a problem which was an inner London problem, I'm trying to explain that in my own mind. The work which I did for my PhD thesis, which is a long time ago now, was looking at residential location in London, and what one showed was that because the cost of space was higher near the centre, families, households tended to be smaller, and larger households were located near the edge. So the reason why I interpret that you don't get an inner-outer pattern is because the problem of housing costs is higher near the centre, but the larger families are out towards the edge. So it's the larger families in the south-east where you have a high problem, and so it's the two interacting, and so that's why you get this random pattern.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the first things we asked Navigant Y was, and they ran a series of sensitivity analysis, and there isn't a single determinant factor, but it does, as you say, rather a composite of the relative affordability of the size of the house relative to the size of the population, depending on who you are and where you choose to live, and that's what you're seeing playing out.
Okay,
hi. My name is Vincenzo. Interested in a technical question from your slides. Did you look at the proportion of those households affected that were living on a 10-year basis, so in a socially rented sector? Because the rents that they pay are set, and so the scope for reduction in terms of the housing benefit 10-year expenditure is less. So I'm wondering, because of the, you know, you looked at 480,000 records, whether there was a 10-year mix in that?
There is, and I think, well, one is that we looked at whether people would be impacted regardless of tenure. So we looked at both social housing tenants, RSL tenants, and also private sector tenants. One, so we could get a full picture, but two, because I kind of alluded to it earlier, because the government is moving to a revenue-led model of affordable housing delivery, i.e. they want to make more use of tenants' rents and give less cash as a grant up front, less capital, we thought it was worth exploring within that context, because it's our sense, It's been a while since I looked at the debate, so it might be a reality. But I suspect that local authority and RSL rents, i.e. social rents, are potentially going to be unfettered to allow them to build, or not necessarily local authority as much. There will be some movement around what counts as an affordable rent in that sense. So we did look at it. Yes, so there is. So I guess there is less scope for, the rents are currently lower, but there's no guarantee that the rents are necessarily going to stay low in the longer term. So we thought it was worth including them.
On the back, one in the middle. Yep. Hi, David Dunbar, LSC. Did you do any research into, or similar to that, other research into the effects on landlords? So if you understand the government's ideas that it should depress rents charged in the social sector by the landlords, but do you think that's a realistic?
We did some, I think the last time I looked at it, some of the local housing allowance changes are already in, and I don't think we've seen a fall in London rents. I think they've continued to increase in London. I think I'm reasonably safe in saying that. We did some previous research that with the National Landlords Association, but again, it was a different colleague, different team, that looked at landlords' reactions to a then cut in benefit of, I don't know, we had a kind of side sale percentage, and I think it came back that the majority of landlords, when faced with a benefit reduction of, say, I don't know, 10%, 20%, I'd have to check the figures to get it exactly right, would not renew a tenancy for a family, i.e. they would let, you know, throw them out and make them fine. So I don't know whether that research was commissioned a couple of years ago. I don't know whether if that has changed or whether the position of landlords has changed, but that was that was the research we'd done on it.
Presumably there's some sort of interaction at the moment, because what you have, because of the shortage of mortgages, rents have been going up when house prices haven't been. So you've got, in the short term, rents are going up, but for other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the conversations that I've been having with people around, particularly the NHA, is that it's part of the government trying to control or intervene in the market. And the ability of the government to intervene in rents is pretty, well, any market, but it also, particularly in the housing market in London, is pretty limited. So I don't think we've seen a decrease in rents, and I think probably for the reasons you've just suggested.
Presumably the government sees itself as it were, ceasing to intervene. presumably if less subsidy is paid, the government would argue, indeed has argued, that rents would fall. I mean, not a view on whether that's going to happen, but that their argument would be that they are intervening and that this is intervening less. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, Christy, somebody else has a question.
Yeah, the question I had was the one about the impact on the landlord's rent. So that's what you were asked. The second question is, what about the fears that were expressed a few years ago by the outer London boroughs about people moving from the inner London to the outer in terms of the impact on services, but also the evidence that there has been from the London Council themselves about reserving accommodation in place outside London, Southend or Reading or Bedford or wherever?
I smile because and the colleague who is those remarks are attributable is forever being reminded that he condemned the residents of Southend to an exodus of people from London. There is anecdotal evidence of people moving around, particularly local authorities, in placing people in temporary accommodation. I think the fairest way to say it is that we haven't yet got a handle on where people are moving in a kind of rigorous, evidence-based way, although we have heard anecdotally of people moving to particular boroughs. And if, just to take the inner outer London dynamic of outer London boroughs saying, well, hang on guys, we've got our own supply problems. There isn't a, I think it's probably, if I had a Tom from Redbury sitting on my shoulder, they would say there isn't a pool of households available in outer London. However, there is some movement, I guess, around London from, say, inner to outer that's happening anyway. And it's something that we're trying to document and trying to evidence and get a handle for how much that's actually happening. But as far as I know, there is no, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, there is no rigorous approach to kind of tracking where people have moved, i.e. from London from inner London to Southend or to Margate or anything. There isn't any evidence that suggests that, other than anecdotal.
Christine?
Well, two things. I guess the answer to that is that EWP can do it.
Right, yes.
They probably won't, but they can.
Yeah.
They have a unique number for the person, and if they're still eligible for benefit, then the computer will pick up where they've moved from and to.
Yeah.
And therefore, the only people who are going to be able to identify that type of movement is DWP itself,
yeah.
The confidential data. My concern is a bit, and like many other people, I'm slightly behind the times on this, but I'm worried about the mix of LHA and universal credit in the sense that LHA can't directly affect social tenants.
No.
Under occupation can, but that's a different story. Because no social landlord will put the rent above the LHA limit, and so all social tenants will get that rent. And Andrew knows the figures and I don't, the proportion of people who are affected by universal credit during the social sector is very high, isn't it?
Yes.
This is about the fact that the social sector houses large households.
Yes.
And
yes.
That large households actually dominate this story.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who were down the far end of the chart of the two lines, weren't they?
Yes.
And of course, the reality is that were the universal credit to be put in the way that it is at the present time, and we do go down the affordable rent regime, then that will be a considerable worsening for those groups of households.
Yes.
But one reason you can't work out the inner London, outer London to some extent, where the 30% of the market lies.
Yeah.
And that is something which is determined by the distribution of income of the totality of the sectors. I guess that's what's causing some of your story.
Yep.
Yes, well, I would like to follow up from that because I didn't quite understand your last thing about the local authority finance and how it would affect all these potential movements, would affect them. Because you said there's a correlation between the deprivation and how much is being spent on people, makes sense. But if you assume, for example, that everybody is moving to Newham because it's cheaper rents and stuff like that, because they're pushed out because they can't pay the difference, of this rent which they would have to do after all these changes. Wouldn't that then affect the actual budget of that borough? So we just have our pot and it will have to be divided by twice as many people. So in fact, this correlation would no longer stand.
Well, it's to
do the cost and the deprivation.
I guess it's to do with the way that, I'm not a local government finance expert, but the way that local authorities are funded will lag the movement of people. So you're potentially looking at a situation where if you move from inner London to outer London, you will have just the way that the, and perhaps the deprivation bit is a slight complication, but if you just take the average in a London borough, an average person in London would have, say, £1,500 notionally against their head. Now, if they move to outer London, well, there's only a notional £1,000 against their head. So immediately you've got a £500 gap between the inner London cash against a person and the out London cash. Now, a bit of a further complication to that is that, hang on a minute, it's not just going to be a £1,000 gap, because we're not just talking about average households, we're potentially talking about households in deprivation. And I think I've modelled it as about 25%. So about a 25% premium attached to a deprived household. So then you've got a situation where it's not, it's a £750 gap. And that's just from moving the household. So that expenditure will need to be borne by the out London borough kind of right away. There'll be a kind of a surplus, for want of a better phrase, or readjustment in the inner London borough, but that won't be taken account of directly by the government with its...
With the allocation of the grant?
Yeah, with the it won't be taken account directly, so there'll be a
lag. Let me add, at the risk of ruining the Dad's already building excitement in front of the seminar on the for the seminar on the 13th, by coincidence, the local government finance system is itself being reformed in April 2013. And that will have the effect of freezing the relative need positions and indeed resource positions of authorities at that point for some as yet unknown period in the future. So if a large number of relatively poor people were to move from one part of the city to another, then the receiving borough could well find itself with them arriving, but no change in the underlying need grant, because that world is over. And now in the new world, where they compete for tax base and where the need position will be frozen where it was in 2013-14. But as I say, do come back on the 13th of February. The point is well precisely made. I mean, there's also the housing benefit system. So the council tax benefit is also being reformed on the 1st of April 2013, which also has an impact on all of this.
I was interested in whether you're going to extend this research to the, in terms of the kind of social polarisation, spatial distribution consequences, to what's happening in terms of the redefinition of affordable rent in terms of the new housing association programme. Because there was a bit of implication that earlier that a local authority weren't necessarily set a rent level above a cap. On the other hand, there's a theoretical possibility, at least, that some of the new so-called affordable rent programme at 80% of market rent could actually be above a cap. And that clearly actually has, and given that's in a sense a matter for, to a certain extent, local determination, as long as you don't go above the 80% of market rent, and obviously the market rent is individual property determined, I'm just concerned, you know, to what extent there could be further social polarisation consequences as a result of differential policies adopted either by housing associations or by individual boroughs and groups of associations within boroughs on how close to 80% market rent they go. And of course the discretion that you can set different levels in relation to market rent for different sizes of property. So, given that's something in the sense that local authorities have more control over than rents charged in the private rent sector, I'm just interested in whether your research is also going to be trying to examine the impact of your own members' individual decisions as well as those of the private sector.
Well, it's a... I should probably kind of caveat that, but what I'm going to say is that it's an area that's come up, that came up in the affordable rent modelling and affordable rent perspectives for that. And I think at one stage, I think it's fair to say that the DWP and the CLG, at least publicly, if not privately, seem to be on a different page about what affordable rent would mean and how that would impact on the universal credit. That clearly, we're not privy to all the, or I'm not privy, or my colleagues are not privy to all the conversations that happen between CLG and DWP. But at one stage, it almost looked like the government was potentially using housing benefit expenditure to drive an affordable rents programme, because they'd be paid up would come out of the housing benefit bill and they'd reduce capital grant for affordable housing. I haven't been involved in the conversations recently, but I do remember that there was a distinct fear of a kind of, I'm not sure how this is borne out by policy, of a kind of narrative account which would suggest, hang on a minute, what you do is you suddenly start to set up universal credit, you put people into a situation where they're reliant on rents in order to build new homes, and then you unfetter local authorities, RSLs, to charge whatever they see as a kind of a site viability-based calculation, i.e. they need to charge 60 or 70% in order to make the site viable. Now, I know there's been a lot of work around making the affordable rent model work in London. I think that the average rent in London at the moment is about 65% rather than up to 80% of market rents.
That's what the mayor is claiming.
Okay, well, I wouldn't want to disagree with the mayor.
Is that a yes?
In a forum such as this.
I think no data has been provided despite numerous requests.
Let's take it to 65 for now.
I think it's fair to say that it's what TSA is claiming as well.
Okay, keep going, sorry.
So, I think I'm probably... I probably almost kind of at liberty, not free to kind of really speculate too much on where things might go in the future. However, there's definitely a logical or intellectual argument about marketizing or deregulating kind of social element of this, and at the same time changing the housing benefit and universal credit regime, and what the interactions of that and how they will play out, and how that will lead to, what that will do to the next round of affordable housing. I think probably, you know, that's probably a bit technical if you were not a housing expert or a welfare reform expert, but I think the implications on rent levels in London and on housing supply they're probably, you know, still up for discussion and still up for grabs. I think we'll just have to see.
Given that some of the biggest effects of the universal credit reform, moving to that new system, will be, and this is building on Christine's point, on larger households, I think we agree with that, right? Larger, poorer households. Presumably there's also an impact by ethnic group, or by minority and ethnic group, is that right?
Well,
sounds logical, but
it sounds logical. It was something that we were specifically interested in looking at, but the single housing benefit extract, i.e. the raw data we use to conduct this analysis, doesn't hold ethnicity data for each of the claimants. So we have no you know, firm evidence on which to suspect that. We only have kind of inference.
But you could, with a step between, presumably, we know that larger families tend to come from certain relatively... some certain backgrounds, certain kinds of religious and other minority groups, and therefore, even if the populations, see what I'm getting at here.
I'm putting it slightly more tactfully than Karen, but I'm putting Richie got into trouble.
Oh, right, okay. Well, anyway, yeah, so it will affect different groups, likely affect different ethnic and religious and minority groups differently.
Possibly, yes.
Possibly, yes. All right, fine.
But implicitly in the assessment, whatever the impact thing's called nowadays, it was raised as an issue of discrimination. I think this is something to do with the definition of discrimination in this context, that it cannot be discrimination if it doesn't mention any of those things.
Yeah.
So it does get... It's not called by discrimination stories, but it must impact. It would be odd if it weren't true. But I think there is an issue about the extent to which people are going, which the responses are to alleviate the problems, which are, to some extent, which of course is highly desirable at one level, but helps to undermine the political process to some extent. But as my understanding is, it is that on average rents are about 65%, but the average rent for the 3- and 4-bedroom house is much lower than that. And therefore, they're not that far different from the social rents that are currently being charged.
Yes.
And therefore, you've responded to the welfare cap in exactly the way that the government wanted you to respond to the welfare cap, by saying, right, we will continue to cross-subsidise between small households and larger households.
Yes.
But can we come back to your I know it's a more difficult bit, but the internal story about whether you go for the child benefit story or whether you go for the relationship to income story. And it seems to be clear from the figures which you're getting out that the children are the significant losers.